Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us a bird's eye view of the Vatican Week. But first, Jill Bevilacqua brings us the next in her series of reflections on the Sunday Gospel by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading this week's Gospel for us.
Jesus told his disciples a parable on the necessity of praying always and not losing heart. Once there was a judge in a certain city who respected neither God nor man. A widow in that city kept coming to him, saying, "Give me my rights against my opponent." For a time he refused, but finally he thought, "I care little for God or man. But this widow is wearing me out. I'm going to settle in her favor, or she'll end by doing me violence." The Lord said, "Listen to what the corrupt judge has to say. Will not God then do justice to his chosen, who call out to him day and night? Will he delay long over them, do you suppose? I tell you, he will give them swift justice. But when the Son of Man comes, will he find any faith on the earth?"
Let's go straight to the protagonists in the parable our Lord tells this Sunday. First, the judge, described in different versions as unjust, corrupt, unscrupulous, unrighteous, or simply, as here, as a judge who respected neither God nor man. What kind of justice might anyone expect from a man like this? Certainly a widow, with probably no resources whatsoever, would have little chance of influencing a man of this sort. He would care little for her rights, that's for sure. And indeed, he decides in her favour only because she has worn him out with her persistence, and because he's afraid of what she might do next. Judges, wrote Francis Bacon in 1625, ought to remember that their office is to interpret law, not to make law or give law. And again, let judges also remember that Solomon's throne was supported by lions on both sides. Let them be lions, but yet lions under the throne. Solomon's wisdom as a judge has come down to us in one of the most famous of all Bible stories, that of the two women who claimed the same child. Both had given birth at the same time, but one of the babies had died. Each claimed that the live child was hers. To Solomon they went for a judgment as to whom the child belonged. "Bring me a sword," ordered Solomon, "and I will cut the child in half, so that each may have half." And at this the true mother cried out in protest, "Let her have the child, but do it no harm." And so Solomon knew she was the child's mother, and handed her the babe. Judges of such calibre may be few and far between, but there are not many who have gone down in history as failing totally in their almost sacred task. There have been those one would not have relished meeting, such as the notorious Judge Jeffreys, whose trials in the English West Country of the followers of the Duke of Monmouth, rebels against the crown, earned him the name of the Hanging Judge. Certainly, men and women of the law, be they judges or advocates, walk a tightrope in a world where one false step, the acceptance of a single bribe, means the loss of personal integrity, never to be recovered. A man there was, himself the son of a judge, who followed the profession of advocate, and of whom it was written that,
"In all his great offices and doings for the king and the realm, so many years together, had from all corruption of wrongdoing or bribes taking, kept himself so clear that no man was able therewith once to blemish him or make just quarrel against him."
The man was Sir Thomas More, Lord Chancellor of Henry VIII, executed by the King in 1535 for refusing to recognize him as head of the English Church and canonized saint 400 years later. But despite this declaration of More's integrity, quoted from the life of More written by his son-in-law, William Roper, attempts were made to blacken More's name by suggesting that he had accepted bribes. In Robert Bolt's play about More, A Man for All Seasons, the dramatist uses the example of the woman who sent More a silver cup, in the hope that when she brought her case before him, he would give judgment in her favour. But, the character says, as soon as he realised it was a bribe, he got rid of it. More was very well aware of the implications of accepting a bribe. As he says in the play, in office they offer you all sorts of things. The point was to be able to distinguish between a genuine gift and one which compromised the recipient. In one famous case, More was accused by a certain Parnell, against whom More had made a decree while Lord Chancellor, of having received a bribe from his adversary, a certain Vaughan. In Roper's words,
this Parnell to His Highness most grievously complained that Sir Thomas More, for making the same decree, had of the same Vaughan, unable for the gout to travel abroad himself, by the hands of his wife, taken a fair great gilt cup for a bribe.
The matter came before the Council of Lords, and Parnell told his tale and swore that More had admitted receiving the cup. But Thomas More was not only incorruptible, he was an astute lawyer and diplomat, and he had a delightful sense of humour. Roper tells us what happened next.
Whereupon Sir Thomas More desired their lordships that as they had courteously heard him tell the one part of his tale, so they would vouchsafe of their honours indifferently to hear the other. After which obtained, he further declared unto them that, albeit he had indeed, with much work, received that cup, yet immediately thereupon he caused his butler to fill it with wine, and of that cup drank to her, and that when he had done so, and she pledged him, then as freely as her husband had given it to him, even so freely gave her the same unto her again, to give unto her husband as his New Year's gift, which, at his instant request, though much against her will, at length yet she was fain to receive, as herself and certain other there presently before them deposed. Thus was the great mountain turned scant to a little molehill.
And Roper cannot resist another story in the same vein.
So I remember that at another time upon a New Year's Day, there came to him one Mistress Crocker, a rich widow, for whom, with no small pain, he had made a decree in the Chancery against the Lord Arundel, to present him with a pair of gloves and £40 in gold coin, in them for a New Year's gift. Of whom he thankfully receiving the gloves, but refusing the money, said unto her, Mistress, since it were against good manners to forsake a gentlewoman's New Year's gift, I am content to take your gloves, but as for your money, I utterly refuse. So, much against her mind, enforced he her to take her gold again.
From judges now, let us pass to widows, often cited in the scriptures. In the words of our Lord, the widow's mite, which was worth more than all the rest of the offerings cast into the temple treasury, because she of her want cast in all she had. And just before, he'd been telling the people to beware of the scribes, who devour the houses of widows under the pretense of long prayer. Our Lord's compassion for the widow of Nain and his restoring of her son to life. Back in the Old Testament, the Mosaic law declared, you shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn. And St. James, in his letter, declares that religion that is pure and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Alas, none of these laws or instructions or acts of pity towards widows would have moved our unjust judge. One thing, and one thing alone, decides him to act in favour of the widow: her persistence. Like the dominant note in music, her plea cannot be ignored. In his poem, A Toccata of Galuppi's, Robert Browning imagines Galuppi, the 18th century composer from the island of Burano near Venice, sitting at the clavichord, and exclaims, "Hark, the dominant's persistence, till it must be answered to." And in the different versions of today's gospel, the theme is always the same: to persevere in prayer. Always to pray and not lose heart. Pray continually and never lose heart. We ought always to pray and not to faint. That last is a vivid image used often by writers. Shakespeare has one character say of another, "He prays but faintly and would be denied." And a 17th century metaphysical poet, Francis Quarles, wrote, "He teaches to deny that faintly prays." And Shakespeare again in Troilus and Cressida has Ulysses say to Achilles, who's losing heart, "Perseverance, dear my lord, keeps honour bright. To have done is to hang quite out of fashion, like a rusty mail in monumental mockery." Mail, of course, meaning coat of mail, for Ulysses was talking to a soldier. In our own Vatican Radio Almanac of Evening Thoughts, for September the 20th of the year 2000, we find these words of the French 19th century writer Victor Hugo: "Almost the whole secret of great souls is contained in this word, persevere." What emerges from these various reflections on perseverance in prayer seems to be that before we get a positive answer, we're going to have a lot of negative ones, or none at all. That this happens to even the most fervent of clergymen is borne out by this poem, written by the man who's been described as the most purely devotional of English poets, George Herbert, 17th century metaphysical poet and country parson. Here now is Denial.
"When my devotions could not pierce thy silent ears, then was my heart broken, as was my verse. My breast was full of fears and disorder. My bent thoughts, like a brittle bow, did fly asunder. Each took his way. Some would to pleasure go, some to the wars and thunder of alarms. As good go anywhere, they say, as to benumb both knees and heart in crying night and day, 'Come, come, my God, O come!' But no hearing. Oh, that thou shouldst give dust a tongue to cry to thee, and then not hear it crying. All day long my heart was in my knee, but no hearing. Therefore my soul lay out of sight, untuned, unstrung, my feeble spirit unable to look right, like a nipped blossom hung discontented. Oh, cheer and tune my heartless breast, defer no time, that so thy favours granting my request, they and my mind may chime and mend my rhyme."
The great Teresa of Avila admitted that for years she'd found it hard to concentrate in prayer. But she wrote that God does not leave us without help if we approach him humbly. If a whole year passes without receiving what we ask, we should be ready to try longer. Such time is well spent. And the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore puts the same thought into his own unique words.
"Clouds heap upon clouds, and it darkens. Love, why dost thou let me wait outside at the door all alone? In the busiest moments of the noontide work, I am with the crowd. But on this dark, lonely day, it is only for thee that I hope. If thou showest me not thy face, if thou leavest me wholly aside, I know not how I'm to pass these long, rainy hours. I keep gazing on the faraway gloom of the sky, and my heart wanders wailing with the restless wind. If thou speakest not, I will fill my heart with thy silence and endure it. I will keep still and wait like the night with starry vigil and its head bent low with patience. The morning will surely come, the darkness will vanish, and thy voice pour down in golden streams breaking through the sky. Then thy words will take wings in songs from every one of my birds' nests, and thy melodies will break forth in flowers in all my forest groves.
We're listening there to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, time to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, who's about to bring us the Vatican Week in review. Joan, so we had a Marian weekend, didn't we?
Last weekend was really sensational, huge numbers of people, but this is all part of the Year of Faith, these big weekends, the recent one for catechist and this one for Mary. And we had a vigil in St. Peter's Square. The statue, here was the amazing thing, the statue of Our Lady of Fatima.
The original one.
Was the original one that has the bullet in the crown that came out of John Paul when he was shot in 1981, and he gave it to Our Lady. He was convinced it was her hand that deflected the bullet to such a point that he was not actually killed in St. Peter's Square during that attempt. So the original statue was flown in, I think it was in Rome for 36 hours, something else like that. And actually, in Fatima, there was a huge celebration because Sunday the 13th marked the 96th anniversary of Our Lady's appearance in Fatima. So, I mean, 1917, we're going to have the
100th. The last apparition.
Exactly. And so you didn't have the statue because it was in Rome with the Holy Father. But the interesting and beautiful thing was that the statue began its visit to Rome and the Vatican in the home of Benedict XVI, Pope Emeritus. So it was brought in a very beautiful procession to the monastery where he lives. And then he prayed before it very briefly in the chapel. And really Mary traveled last weekend because she was in St. Peter's Square for the vigil in the afternoon with the Pope and a huge crowd. Then she was taken to the Shrine of Divine Love. And by the way, this was all done with the Italian Air Force. There was a long overnight vigil, early morning mass at the Shrine of Divine Love, after which the statue was brought back to Rome for a while. It was in Santa Marta, where Pope Francis resides. And then, of course, it was in the square for the Mass and the Angelus.
There was an act of entrustment, wasn't there?
Oh, that was the beautiful part
of
Fatima. And it was a prayer written by the Holy Father. Also happening over the weekend, this is kind of a cute story. Earlier in the summer, the people who make the Harley-Davidson bike, they were celebrating an anniversary of the company, 110th anniversary of the company. And so in June, the Holy Father was given a Harley-Davidson when 35,000 motorbike aficionados were in Rome to celebrate this anniversary. And so the Pope has ended up, which we suspected anyway, they were kind of, you know, saying at the time that he would sell this and put the money towards charity. And as a matter of fact, it will be auctioned off. I'm sure we'll hear the results of that sometime, to help refurbish a soup kitchen and a hostel for the poor in Rome. Now, Monday was kind of quiet, but Tuesday was a very
important... Tuesday was a landmark moment for
yes,
the Vatican, wasn't it?
It really...
If you will.
Yeah, it really was. Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, who has been the Secretary of State since September 2006, the 15th of October was his last day as Secretary of State, and his successor is Archbishop Pietro Parolin, who is a very, very respected diplomat, a multilingual person, which is very much in his favor. He has his background is in diplomacy, even at very young ages. He was in the Secretariat of State. So, I mean, he knows...
He has all the experience.
He really does. He knows the world leaders. The world leaders know him and trust him. And that's the most important thing. And he's very popular among diplomats, those accredited to the Vatican, and then among the Vatican's own diplomatic corps. So a very important day. Actually, it was important also because, as the Pope said, with a little bit of laughter, he went to an office in the Secretariat of State where there was the handover of the baton, if you will. But Archbishop Parolin had kind of an apparently emergency surgery, was not actually present. So the Pope, Pope Francis, welcomed him, as in his own words, in absentia.
Wednesday?
Wednesday, the typical audience day, but it was also a big day because being October 16th, it actually marked the 35th anniversary of the election of John Paul to the papacy. So, and the Holy Father did recall that at the end of the catechesis, which, of course, has been continuing on the creed. I'll go to that in a minute, but when in the multi-language groups, the only language the Holy Father does speak is, other than Italian, is his native Spanish. Other greetings are given. He'll greet English pilgrims. One of the Monsignors will read it in English, and the Holy Father has his words in Italian. So he remembered very much the anniversary, speaking very specifically to the Polish people. And then the audience, it's really been fascinating. At the end, we're going to want to put all these catecheses together because the Holy Father talks about the creed. And he spoke of the unity and the holiness and the Catholicity of the Church. And then on Wednesday, he spoke of its apostolic nature. And he said, of course, to profess the Church as apostolic means underlining her bond with the apostles, with that small group of 12 men whom Jesus called to him by name one day, and to ask them to stay with him and send them to preach. Indeed, and I didn't know this until the Wednesday audience. If I'd studied Greek, I would have. Apostle is a Greek word meaning messenger or envoy. So a very, very interesting catechesis. And I'm sure that our listeners do know by now that the full catechesis, which is always given in Italian, is on the Vatican website. And then there is always, for the languages present, including Arabic, for over a year now, there is always a small summary of the Pope's catechesis.
So, which echoes the...
If you don't have time to read the, you know, to read the full thing or follow it, the summary is wonderful. But also that same day, a very important message was written by Pope Francis to Jose Graziano de Silva. He's the Director General of the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, known as FAO, F-A-O, which is headquartered right here in Rome. And then every year on October 16th, FAO marks the foundation, and there is a theme for the celebrations this year, Sustainable Food Systems for Food Security and Nutrition. And the Pope in his remarks spoke of the paradox of the fact we've got globalization, we've got countries linked with each other in good and in bad, but especially communications, the globalization of communications, meaning we can find out about countries. And what we're finding out is not necessarily that good. When you look at the poverty and the hunger in the world, of the number of people that go to bed every night and then the number of people that have excess food. And so he really highlighted that and said something must change in ourselves, in our mentality, and in our societies to avoid, to eliminate the problems of hunger and malnutrition. And the Pope said never, ever should they be considered a fact of life.
Then there was an unusual story on Wednesday, no?
As a matter of fact, the Vatican made an announcement that day that an outside firm had been hired to review APSA. APSA is the acronym for the Administration of the Patrimony of the Apostolic See. And so in this announcement that was made public, the presidency of APSA announced a new supervisory board and a review that would be conducted by an independent firm, outside non-Vatican firm, the same one also doing a review of IOR, the Vatican Bank. And APSA is kind of an umbrella term for an organization in the Roman Curia that the patrimony of the Apostolic See can be understood in two terms, employees, people, and then property. You have real estate. So they own real estate in Rome. Buildings in which many Vatican employees live are Vatican-owned buildings. And Just to clear up one thing, a lot of these buildings, they've been around for a long, long time, and they were given to the Vatican in 1929 when the Lateran Pacts were created, were signed, creating Vatican City State as we know it today. This was in compensation for all the territory, the Papal States, that had been confiscated many years earlier to create what we now know, of course, as the Republic of Italy, first a kingdom, then a republic. So all these lands, buildings, et cetera, were confiscated, and the Vatican, the Church, the Holy See was never compensated. So that happened in 1929. Part of that agreement was the giving of a lot of physical property to the Vatican. So it wasn't that they went out and bought acres and acres and buildings of land. And land, by the way, and buildings in Rome and elsewhere are gifted to the Vatican. Many people leave things in their will. And then, almost I think it was that same day, we have another big but unusual piece of news. And that is to say that the Vatican has won the bid for control of the .Catholic internet domain. Now, they won this. They had made a bid last year. There was a bidding process with ICANN, ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. So this is the entity that sets the protocol for internet addresses. There's top-level domains. There's .Catholic, which fell under that. And so the Vatican bid for this and won this and actually can now, as the owner of this, can now decide who can be in that domain, .Catholic. So an organization, a newspaper, etc., will they be allowed to have that .Catholic?
In various languages, no?
In various languages, yes. And when I think most of our listeners are very familiar with .gov, .net, .com. These have been around for a long time. But then there are new .dot words that are coming out. There's like .dot book, .dot, I can't remember all of them, but there were a whole number of new domain names. So, and then the other big news of the week, of course, the Holy Father. Right, the Holy Father continues to receive heads of state. Friday was the president of Cameroon, but Thursday was a very big day. He received the president of Palestine, the Mahmoud Abbas, and obviously that part of the world is how many years have we in the media been talking about the peace process? Certainly well over 60 years in the Middle East. And so we had Abbas and the Holy Father. I would love to have been a fly on the wall in that interesting conversation for sure. And Abbas, I know in an interview not given in the Vatican but later, sounded very, very hopeful, expressed to the Holy Father that he would like to, this was not a Vatican communique but another one, and Abbas said he would like to sign an agreement, a peace agreement with Israel within the year. So,
Let's be hopeful.
All we can do is be hopeful. I mean, if you lose hope and you lose the power to pray, then what is left? So,
well, thank you very much, Jo.
An amazing week, yes.
And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at this same time next weekend. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.